God keeps his promises. What God says, he will do. God always speaks the truth. He never lies. We can depend on what God says. He will never, ever lead us astray. And I would be curious as to how many times in the Bible we find these truths repeated time and time again. Now, what would be the total of the occurrences of verses in the Scripture emphasizing this truth that God is one who keeps his promise? As we read the pages of the Bible, we find prophecy after prophecy after prophecy that is fulfilled in complete accordance with what God had earlier said. We find hundreds upon hundreds of events from history that are a testimony to the fact that God is faithful to his word. And there's much in the Scriptures that we could classify as fulfilled prophecy. There's also much in the Scriptures that is unfulfilled prophecy that will yet be coming to pass. And we can rest assured today that the God who was faithful in the past to keep his word will be just as faithful in the present to keep his word, and he will be faithful in the future to keep his word as well. We have no need to worry that God will somehow fail to keep his promises. No, God will keep his promises. We can rest assured that God does not change. He will remain dependable in the present and in the future, just as he has been dependable in the past. Are you encouraged today that our God is faithful, he is true, he is a God who keeps his promises? You know, where would we be at if God was not faithful to his word? What hope would we have if God didn't keep his promises? You know, we wouldn't have any hope, would we? We wouldn't have any ground or any basis to live our lives upon. But God does keep his word, and we can live in confidence in light of the truth that God keeps his word. This evening we return to the book of Judges, and specifically we come to the section of chapters dealing with the life of Samson. And if you remember from Judges chapter 13, there is a certain angel of the Lord that appeared to the wife of a man named Manoah. And to this woman, the angel said these words that we find recorded in Judges chapter 13 in verses 3 through 5. And if you want to turn there, you can. We'll be focusing on Judges 15 this evening. But this is what we read earlier in Judges chapter 13 in verses 3 through 5. This is what the angel of the Lord says to Manoah's wife. Behold now, thou art barren and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. How incredible were those instructions that this angel of the Lord gave to Manoah's wife. Not only did she learn that she would soon conceive and she would give birth to a son, but she was also informed this is how you need to be living your life in preparation for these events, the conception and birth of this son. Her son was to be a Nazarite. She needed to adhere to certain dietary regulations or restrictions in light of this fact that he would be a Nazarite. And what's more, Manoah's wife was told God's purpose for this child. God had a plan for this child. This child would begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Those are some incredible promises given to Manoah's wife. She must have had extreme, abundant joy as she heard these words. What awe must have filled her heart. And God did fulfill the promise to Manoah's wife that she would conceive. And she gave birth to a son. All of that came to pass. We find that in Judges chapter 13, verse 24. The woman had a son. She called his name Samson. The child grew. The Lord blessed him. God was faithful to keep that promise to Manoah's wife. The word that she would conceive and give birth to a son, at the point in time that that Manoah's wife heard those words, maybe it seemed incredible because she was barren. She was unable, naturally speaking, to have children. But God is all-powerful, and it's within God's power to close a womb. It's within God's power to open a womb. And for Manoah's wife, God chose to open her womb, but before he even did that, he declared to her his plan. You are going to conceive. You are going to bear a son. God kept his word in relation to the conception and the birth of Samson. And we also find, as we read through Judges here, that not only would he keep his promise about the conception and birth of Samson, but also God would keep his word about the role Samson would play. Even before his birth, even before his conception, the angel said to Samson, or to Samson's mother, to Manoah's wife, "This one, this son of yours, is going to begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines." God promised that to Manoah's wife. And God would do what he had said, just as he had done earlier what he had said. Now, at first, Samson's mother may have wondered, well, is God really going to keep this promise? And how would God keep this promise? And as we come to Judges chapter 14, we read of Samson going to a town called Timnah. And there he saw a certain Philistine girl. And Samson was intent on marrying this girl. And Samson demanded of his parents that they make the necessary arrangements for this marriage. And we aren't going to get into all the details of what was involved with this. But his parents were taken back with this request or this demand. Their hearts were abundantly grieved, no doubt. Because God had told the Israelites time and time again, do not intermarry with the people of the land. Don't do that. Don't intermarry with idolaters, because they will only draw you astray from the worship of the true God. Now, God had already promised Manoah's wife that he would begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines through Samson's hand. But here is Samson. What is Samson wanting to do? Instead of wanting to deliver Israel from the Philistines, what is he wanting to do? He's wanting to intermarry with the Philistines. Okay, so how is God's promise going to come about? And maybe Samson's mother began to wonder, did God really mean what he said whenever he talked about Samson being Israel's savior from their enemy? Now, little did Samson's parents know that this turn of events was in accord with God's declared plan for Samson. God was using Samson's love for a Philistine girl. God was using that love as an opportunity to work against the Philistines, to judge them, to inflict harm upon them. And so as we continue through the summary of the narrative, we have Samson's parents grudgingly making arrangements for their son's wedding to this girl. And in the process of time, the wedding festivities began. And as was common in those days, there was some fun and frivolity. And it was a wedding. It was a week-long wedding feast that was involved here. And as part of the fun, Samson proposed a riddle. And we can go to the text and read that riddle. We're not going to get into all the details of it. But the condition was, if the Philistines solved the riddle, and this was directed to 30 of the wedding companions here, Samson's friends, we could say, his wedding companions. But if those 30 Philistines solved the riddle, he would give to each of them a set of clothes. Now, for us, that may not seem like much, but in those days, that was quite the gift. So if they solved the riddle, Samson would give them something valuable. But if they didn't solve the riddle, then each of them would have to give him a set of clothes. So Samson would have quite a bit of clothes if he won this arrangement. So for most of the feast, no one could solve the riddle. Try as hard as they might, and I can imagine them asking Samson, well, is this the answer? Is that the answer? But none of them could figure out the answer. So eventually, the Philistines pressured Samson's wife to get the answer from Samson. And eventually, Samson's wife succeeded, and then Samson's wife disclosed the answer to the fellow Philistines, and at the very last hour of the feast, the 30 companions gave the answer to Samson's riddle. And Samson was enraged, as you can imagine, but he was intent on keeping his vow. And he needed to come up with 30 sets of clothing, but he didn't have 30 sets of clothing at hand. You know, who had that many sets of clothing? So what did he do? He went down to the Philistine city of Ashkelon, and there he killed 30 men, and he stripped them of their belongings, and he gave their clothes to his wedding companions. Again, we're not going to get into all the details of this. I've already preached on this passage. But Samson, after he gave his wedding companions the clothes that he promised, he went to his father's house. He left his wife behind. His wife then was given to a fellow Philistine. She was given to Samson's companion, the one we might call as the best man. And so it's in this context that we come to our present chapter in chapter 15. And already we see how God is beginning to work through Samson to keep his promise. We have 30 men that Samson killed to keep his vow. And with those 30 men killed, God was surely beginning to use Samson to deliver his people. But did anyone really recognize that God is at work through Samson? Or did people just think, well, there is Samson, he went into a fit of rage and he did something that is just kind of off the wall? But with our chapter this evening, both Samson and many others would recognize that God was working through Samson to begin to deliver his people Israel from the hands of the Philistines. God was keeping his promise. He was working in a way that nobody would have guessed, but God was keeping his promise. Judges chapter 15, if you're using one of our pew Bibles, it's page 295. And this is what we read in verses 1 and 2. But it came to pass within a while after, in the time of wheat harvest, that Samson visited his wife with a kid, and he said, I will go into my wife into the chamber. But her father would not suffer him to go in. And her father said, I verily thought that thou hadst utterly hated her. Therefore I gave her to thy companion. Is not her younger sister fairer than she? Take her, I pray thee, instead of her. So some time has passed now, and it seems that by this time, and we don't know how many months have transpired, but I imagine a number of months. So the wedding feast that Samson had with his companions and with his wife was far from enjoyable. And Samson left in a fit of rage. He went to his father's house. But now it's the wheat harvest, maybe late April, May, and it seems that his anger has subsided now, and once again he wants to see his wife. And maybe he thought that his wife wouldn't be too happy with him because of his hasty departure. Maybe he thought that, you know, his wife would need to be won over. And in our day and age, we'd think, well, maybe Samson would have brought her a bouquet of roses, you know, to try to win over his wife. Well, what does Samson bring? He brings a kid or a young goat. And maybe the thought was, well, we can have a nice meal together, you know, because it was quite different in those days. You know, you'd slaughter the goats and then you'd eat it. And so here he's bringing a kid, a young goat, maybe to smooth things over a little bit. But most of all, Samson wanted them to have an enjoyable night together because they were husband and wife. So that seemed to be the thought process of Samson as he went on his way to Timnath to reunite with his wife. But when he arrived at at the house of his wife, the father's house, he declared his intention to visit his wife in her room. And to Samson's surprise, his father-in-law said, no, you can't go in. The father-in-law refused to let Samson see his wife. And then the explanation comes, I thought you hated her. I didn't think you'd ever come back, so I gave her to another man. She is now married to your companion, okay, to the best man of your wedding, if we want to call it that. She is his wife now. But then the father went on to say, well, I have another daughter. She's younger, she's more beautiful, so you can have her. Take her as your wife instead. And maybe Samson's father-in-law thought that the offer would be taken, that that would smooth things over. That was his hope, I think. But we realize, even from the previous context, Samson was intent on this specific Philistine girl. This is the one that he wanted to marry. This is the one he wanted to be his wife. He didn't want her sister, you know. And so we have the response in verse 3, and Samson said concerning them, now shall I be more blameless than the Philistines, though I do them a displeasure. Samson thought in his mind, I have been wronged by the Philistines. And he was intent on paying the Philistines back. You've inflicted hurt upon me, and so I'm going to inflict hurt upon you. And from Samson's perspective, whenever he took action against the Philistines, he'd be innocent of any charge against him. He was simply repaying the Philistines for what they had done to him. The Philistines lashed out against him by taking away his wife, and now he would lash out against the Philistines. And how would he do that? Well, the answer is found in verses 4 and 5. And Samson went and caught 300 foxes, took firebrands, and turned tail to tail, and put a firebrand in the midst between two tails. And when he had set the brands on fire, he let them go into the standing corn of the Philistines and burn up both the shocks and also the standing corn with the vineyards and olives. Now, what we had seen earlier with Samson, it seems to be a personal affront to Samson, doesn't it? Here is a conflict, a disagreement, a wrong against Samson by who? By the father-in-law. You'd think it's more of a personal matter. But how does Samson answer this affront to him? He answers it on a far broader scale. Now, Samson could have personally attacked his father-in-law because of what he had done, giving his wife to another man. But Samson didn't go that route. Samson took action, and it had repercussions throughout the whole land. Samson had a plan. Somehow he caught 300 foxes. Some would say that instead of foxes, they're jackals. But either way, these are wild animals. And he caught them. He divided them into pairs. He took the tail of one, and he somehow tied it to another with a torch between. Okay, so you see how this works. And in a way, it's hard for us to envision this because we've never done anything like this. But Samson figured this out. He wasn't a dumb man by any means. And so he figured this out, tying together the tails of these animals, tail to tail, with a torch between. And then he lit the torch, and he let them go. Can you imagine how those foxes or jackals would have responded? They would run away, but can they run like normal? No, because there's two of them tied together. And so they're probably going this way and that way. Maybe they stop and rest for a little while. But all the time, as Samson let them out in the fields, it's harvest season. You have dry wheat or barley, whatever grain in the fields. All of a sudden, these are erupting into flames. We have the shocks of the gathered grain. Those are burning up as well. And then it's spreading even beyond the grain fields. It's setting on fire the vineyards, the olive trees. So you imagine the smoke just rising up in billows. Here's one man, Samson. He had a creative plan, and he put the plan into action, and he set the whole landscape on fire. And imagine the destruction here. This was no little matter, because the Philistines were no doubt depending on the food from that harvest to feed themselves, to feed the villages and towns. They would sell that grain oftentimes or trade it. And all of it went up in smoke. There's a huge loss here that the Philistines suffered. We have Samson declaring earlier, in essence, I'm going to make you pay. I'm going to be blameless. Well, Samson did make the Philistines pay. And what is the response now? Verse 6. Then the Philistines said, "Who hath done this?" And he answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnites, because he had taken his wife and given her to his companion. And the Philistines came up and burnt her and her father with fire." The Philistines were not happy at all with this situation. Not by any means. There's widespread destruction. There was loss. And they asked the question, who's done this thing? And word got around, Samson is the one who did this. But how is Samson identified? He is the son-in-law of this Timnite. And then they give the reason for Samson's actions. The Timnite gave Samson's wife to another man. And in a way, it seems like the Philistines in general agreed with Samson's earlier proclamation that he would be more blameless or more innocent than the Philistines by what he would do. Samson lost his wife, and it seems as if the Philistines could understand why Samson was so angry and why he did what he did, because this Timnite had given his wife to another man. Now, how do the Philistines respond? You might think, well, they'd go against the man who had set the fire. But that's not what they do. They go against the Timnite, the father-in-law, and the daughter. They killed both the father-in-law and the daughter, Samson's wife. They burnt them with fire. So it seemed that the Philistines were blaming Samson's father-in-law and Samson's wife for all of the havoc upon the land. They're blaming them more than they're blaming Samson, it appears. And they're reckoning if the Timnite wouldn't have given Samson's wife to another man, all of this wouldn't have happened. That's how the Philistines appear to have viewed this all. But how does Samson view all of this? Samson viewed this as a murderous attack, even on his wife, on his father-in-law. Yes, his wife had been given to another man. His father-in-law was responsible for all of this. But Samson loved his wife. Seems as if maybe Samson had a good relation, of sorts anyway, with his father-in-law. And now both of them were dead. They were burned with fire. Samson, again, felt attacked by the Philistines. He couldn't sit idly by and let them attack him like this. And he said, in essence, you need to pay for this. And you will pay for this. And so look at verses 7 and 8. And Samson said unto them, though ye have done this, yet will I be avenged of you, and after that I will cease. And he smote them hip and thigh with a great slaughter, and he went down and dwelt in the top of the rock Etam. Samson announce, I'm going to take vengeance on you, the Philistines, because of what you have done. But then he says, once I've avenged myself, then I will stop. So Samson didn't want an unending war with the Philistines, but neither could Samson let them get away with what they had done. We read that Samson smote them hip and thigh, and that's a figure of speech, and we don't know exactly what's involved here, but it talks about a great slaughter. Now, how did he kill these Philistines? You know, how many Philistines did he kill? We don't know, but it was a great blow because it was a great slaughter. And after this great slaughter, Samson was true to his word. He left the Philistine territory. He went to Israelite territory. He went to the rock Etam, and there he stayed. And whether he went to this rock and think of maybe a bluff or, you know, some place up high, and he chose that rock maybe because it was secluded, maybe because that way he could see enemies approaching from a distance. We don't know for sure why he chose this rock, but we do know that Samson quit. And maybe he was hoping things would just calm down now. But that's far from the case, as we read in verses 9 and 10. Then the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. And the men of Judah said, why are you come up against us? And they answered, to bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he hath done to us. So you see the escalation of here in the series of events. Samson had done so much harm to their nation. He had burned up their crops, and you have the grain fields and the vineyards and the olive trees. Although maybe the Philistines didn't blame him personally so much for that as they did the Timnite and his daughter. But now, here's Samson killing a number of them. What do the Philistines do now? They mobilize their troops. They come into Israelite territory. They set up their tents in the land of Judah at a place called Lehi. And it seems as if the people of Judah didn't realize what had gone on. You know, it seems that they're caught off guard by this incursion of the Philistine troops. So they send out people to the Philistines to ask, well, why have you come against us? And the answer is, we have come to bind Samson. We've come to do to him as he has done to us. Now, if this were any other account in the book of Judges, what would we have read by now? Samson, after he had attacked the Philistines, he would have gone back to Israelite territory, and he probably would have blown the trumpet or the horn, the ram's horn, and summoned Israel to battle, and the Israelites would have gone against the Philistines in battle. You know, that's probably the scenario earlier in the book of Judges, but what do we find here? We find the people of Judah, and it seems as if, far from wanting to battle the Philistines, they just want to keep the status quo. They want to keep things calm. The men of Judah are quite content to be under Philistine lordship. At least they're content enough that they don't want to stir up the Philistines and have them angry, have any sort of repercussions because of their anger. The Judahites, it seems as if they've come to terms with the situation. They've accepted, well, we as Israel, we are the subject nation. The Philistines, they're the ones in control. But here's Samson. He's caused trouble. He's angered the Philistines, and now they've come with their troops into the land, and something must be done. So look at verses 11 through 13. Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this that thou hast done unto us? And he said unto them, as they did unto me, so have I done unto them. And they said unto him, we are come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistines. And Samson said unto them, swear unto me that you will not fall upon me yourselves. And they spake unto him, saying, no, but we will bind thee fast and deliver thee into their hand, but surely we will not kill thee. And they bound him with two new cords and brought him up from the rock. We can see the fear that the people of Judah had of Samson, or at least the respect. How many men did they bring with them in order to apprehend Samson? 3,000 men. That's incredible, isn't it? How many of the Philistines had come into Judah and set up camp? We don't know, but in the thousands, no doubt. Here are the people of Judah coming to Samson. They don't ask Samson to lead them in battle against the Philistines. No, they come to confront Samson. They confront him about what they consider unruly behavior. Don't you realize the Philistines are our lords? And what have you done to us? You made them so angry. They've come and invaded our land now. And Judah is not pleased at all with Samson. And Samson replies, well, this is what they did to me, so I've done to them in return. As they did to me, I've done to them. They've hurt me, so I hurt them. And for Samson, it seemed all quite cut and dried.
Why is there such a problem with what I've done? And then the men of Judah inform Samson, we've come to bind you, and we're going to hand you over to the Philistines. And Samson doesn't object. Maybe he thought that's how it's going to turn out, but he did ask for one concession, if we want to call it that. Swear to me that you will not harm me. Don't kill me yourself. And the people of Judah say, we won't kill you, but we will bind you. We'll tie you up with ropes. We'll bring you to the Philistines. And that's what they did. They bound him with two new ropes. After they did that, they brought him to the Philistines. And it seems as if with the binding of the two ropes, I imagine on the arms and on the wrists, that's what I envision. And so they're bringing him to the Philistines. And even before we go further in the narrative, I want us just to reflect for a moment the change that has occurred as we've worked our way through the book of Judges. If we go to the early part of the book of Judges, we see a quite different scenario than what we find in the here and now in Judges chapter 15. In the early days of the book of Judges, we read this in chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand. And Judah said unto Simeon his brother, come up with me into my lot, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with thee into thy lot. So Simeon went with him, and Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. And they slew of them in Bezek 10,000 men. So before, early in history, and during this period of the Judges, maybe even what we'd call maybe before the days of the Judges, but leading up to it, Israel was eager to fight against the Canaanites, to take possession of the land God had given them, and Judah was the appointed tribe to go up first, to take their possession, and Judah, along with Simeon, won great victories. They took possession of the land, at least partially, but now what do we find in chapter 15? We have Judah, with 3,000 men, is coming to take one of their own Israelites, a man from the tribe of Dan, but a fellow Israelite. They're coming to not ask him to lead them in battle, but rather coming to take him into custody, to turn him over to the enemy. You see how things have changed. And it's not a change for good. We see the need for the Lord to use Samson to stir matters up, to cause tension between the Philistines and the Israelites. And it seems as if Samson is the only one willing to fight. The people of Judah don't want to fight. Doesn't seem like anybody else wants to fight. No one dares to lift a finger against the Philistines. But going back to our narrative, verses 14 and 15, and when he came, this is Samson, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the cords that were upon his arm became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loosed from off his hands, and he found a new jawbone of an ass or a donkey, and put forth his hand and took it, and slew 1,000 men therewith. The picture here is Samson being brought to Lehi, where the Philistines are encamped, brought probably by the 3,000 men of Judah. And all eyes are upon Samson. And the Philistines, they shout out when they see him. Maybe it's like a battle cry. Maybe it's a shout of joy. Maybe it's a shout mingled with anger because of all that Samson has done and the anticipation here of finally having him in custody. This one who had done so much harm to them, this one who had done so many terrible things to them as a nation, from their perspective. This one that had escaped their grasp, now he's bound, he's going to be delivered to them, and they can do to him as they wish. But with the shout, maybe so loud that it kind of made things tremble, at least we can envision that, a loud shout, something else happened. The Spirit of the Lord rushed upon Samson, and the ropes that bound him, arm and wrist or hand, they became like charred flax. And with supernatural strength, the ropes on his arms and his hands, they were snapped, and Samson was now free. But what weapon did he have? He didn't have a sword, he didn't have a spear, he didn't have a knife even. So what was he to do in the face of this Philistine army? There on the ground, what did he see? He saw a donkey's jawbone. It was still fresh from recent death. And he scooped it up with his hand, and with that jawbone, he killed 1,000 Philistine soldiers. Here are the Philistine soldiers, fully equipped with swords or spears or bows and arrows or javelins or any number of things, but they are no match against Samson with the jawbone of a donkey. And with hundreds of Philistines' corpses piled around him and heaps here and there, No doubt, no living soldiers around him anymore after Samson slew so many. We have Samson saying something, as he oftentimes does, verse 16. And Samson said, "With the jawbone of an ass, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of an ass have I slain 1,000 men." And then verse 17, "And it came to pass when he had made an end of speaking that he cast away the jawbone out of his hand and called that place Ramoth Lehi." Samson had won the battle, one man against thousands, no doubt thousands. We have 1,000 falling in battle. And the Philistines piled up heaps upon heaps, or corpse upon corpse, making heaps. And all of that done with the unlikeliest of weapons, with the jawbone of a donkey. And to commemorate his victory, he called the place Ramoth Lehi, or Jawbone Hill. And we might think the chapter will end now, but the story's not over yet, because look at verse 18. "And he was sore athirst and called on the Lord and said, Thou hast given this great deliverance into the hand of thy servants, and now shall I die for thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised?" Now, none of us can imagine, really personally, we can't really put ourselves in Samson's place. You know, I can't even imagine what it would have been like to be Samson on that day and all that happened to him and all that he did in killing 1,000 Philistine soldiers. I can't even imagine that. He was supernaturally empowered. It was the Spirit of the Lord that came upon him that enabled him to do this great feat. But that doesn't mean that he didn't become exhausted, or at least thirsty. And he was so very thirsty. And it seems as if he was so thirsty that he believed he would soon die, or at least faint from thirst. And so what did he do? For the first time thus far in Judges, Samson calls upon the Lord. And he admits God is the one who gave him the great deliverance. But after such a great victory, would he die of thirst now? What victory would that be if the Philistines would be able to swoop upon him because he had become weakened by thirst, or he had died of thirst? It would be the shame of shames if he fell into the hands of the uncircumcised Philistines. So Samson cries out to God, and God heard his cry. And we have in verse 19, "But God clave an hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout. And when he had drunk, his spirit came again, and he revived. Wherefore he called the place thereof En-Hakkore, which is in Lehi unto this day." Now, from what the King James reads, we would envision that God provided water for Samson out of that jawbone that he just had thrown aside. And that is a possible scenario, but that word for jaw is also the name of the place where the Philistines were encamped. So I believe that Lehi, the place where they encamped, which means jaw, it makes better sense to me that God produced water from a hollow place in the ground there at Lehi, and there was a spring, and it was a continual spring. It quenched Samson's thirst, but also Samson gave a name to this place, En-Hakkore, which means the spring of one who calls or prays. And then the author of Judges notes, it is still in Lehi to this day. So that makes much better sense to me that it was an actual spring that God made rise up, or a source of water that was in this place called Lehi, as opposed to God providing water from the actual jawbone that Samson had used. But what an amazing thing God did for Samson. He gave him this victory over the Philistines. He provided water supernaturally from the rock. And with this note of triumph, we read this in verse 20. "And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. And I wonder, and many others have wondered as well, this mighty act, this great supernatural victory of Samson over the Philistines, was it this victory that caused Israel to recognize Samson as their leader, as the one who would be the God-appointed judge of them? Even the 3,000 people of Judah probably would have acknowledged Samson as their judge, their deliverer. 20 years Samson judged Israel. Now, nothing more is said about conflict during those 20 years. So maybe there was relative peace. There's nothing said about rest in those days, as we find in other accounts of the judges. But maybe both sides decided to have, you know, maybe a sort of agreement here that we're going to keep things as they are. But the Philistines were still in control. It was the days of the Philistines. But God was using Samson as his judge and also as his deliverer to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. So there would be no ultimate deliverance in Samson's lifetime. There, it would come much later than that, in the days of David, I believe, when we have what we'd call the final blow to the Philistines, and maybe even afterwards with Solomon. But there was the beginning of deliverance. But considering what we've looked at thus far in the book of Judges with Samson, chapter 13, chapter 14, chapter 15, who would have thought that God would have worked in such a way to bring deliverance to Israel through this man Samson? This man Samson, who was so infatuated with the Philistine girl, wanting to intermarry with the nation of the Philistia, instead of wanting to judge them and destroy them. But we see how God's hand is at work through all of this. And I'm not saying that Samson was a godly man. He was used of God, but he had many faults, and we'll see more of his faults in chapter 16, the next chapter. But who would have thought that God would have kept his promise to Manoah's wife, to Samson's mother? Who would have guessed that God would have kept his promise in the way that he did? But God did keep his promise. He did. Samson was the one God used to bring the start of deliverance to Israel from the Philistines. Now, if we were in God's shoes, and I'm thankful we aren't, but we would have chosen to do things far differently, I'm sure. But God does things his way in his time. God kept his promise. Years ago, he made this promise to... We don't even know the wife's name, the mother's name, but the wife of Manoah. God said, first of all, you will conceive and bear a son, and he will begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. That was God's promise, and God kept his word. There's even more yet to come, and Samson would yet do more harm to the Philistines, even with his death. But as we step back from what we've seen this evening, remember this: God is a God who keeps his word. What he has promised, he will do. Now, sometimes from our perspective, from our circumstances, we might wonder, well, how is God going to keep his word in this situation? Well, we may not know how God is going to keep his word, how he will fulfill his promises, but rest assured, God will do it in his way, in a way that is perfect. What God says, he will do. And this is the God that Samson served, a God who kept his word. This is the God that we serve today, a God who keeps his word. Are you so thankful that this is the God that we serve? You know, if this was not the God that we served, what hope would we have? What trust could we have in this word, in the Bible? But God keeps his word. He keeps his promises. Thank you, Lord, for keeping your word. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for this example of Samson and this account from his life, and there's more yet to come. But as we read about Samson, we see a lot happening, but we see your hand at work. You promised Samson's mother about the role Samson would play in Israel's history. And even though his mother may have doubted at times how that would come to pass, you were faithful and you kept your word, and you did exactly as you said, though in a way that would have surprised so many different people. Today, I pray that we would also keep in mind and that we'd embrace this truth, that we'd hold on to it tightly. You are a God who keeps your promises. You keep your word. So no matter what is going on in our lives, let us embrace the truths that you have given to us in your word, knowing that you do not lie, you are faithful, you keep your promises. So help us to hold on to this tightly. We thank you for who you are. You are a God who keeps your word. We pray this in Jesus' name.